I guess I'll be using the EPIC model, as Candace was sort of describing EPIC a little bit and the APEX models. And so we'll sort of be applying that to look at the ecosystem responses to bioenergy producing landscapes, particularly soil carbon and soil water or water balance and water quality implications. So I guess the main motivation, like the 2007 U.S. Energy Independence and Security Act mandated a certain level of cellulosic biofuel production by 2022. And they put in some mandates for qualifying as a cellulosic fuel in terms of greenhouse gas reductions relative to petroleum. And agricultural residues are generally considered the most technologically and economically near-term option for meeting this this mandate. And though I think initially it's presumed that if you are deriving biofuels from cellulosic sources that you would be meeting this reduction, findings have demonstrated that that's not always the case. So that can be a particularly limiting factor. And in addition to, you know, residue harvesting potentially having deleterious environmental and soil quality effects. So there's some potential to, you know, increase the feedstock supply capable of meeting these standards, as well as offsetting some of these, you know, negative impacts through conservation management measures. You know, which would include, you know, perennialization or increasing period of crop coverage through and soil cover through, you know, conservation or reduced intensity tillage or incorporation of cover cropping into traditional systems. Potentially production of dedicated bioenergy crops, which could, though, although they would have, you know, more positive soil and environmental impacts, would be expected potentially to increase water use through increased ET and potentially present food versus fuel issues. Essentially, we sort of wanted to focus on, as I mentioned, you know, sort of from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective, focusing on soil carbon impacts, and then from a water quality and quantity perspective. We did a study to estimate, like, what would be the maximum potential residues that could be harvested from the U.S. Midwest. We used the EPIC model, assuming continuous corn production, you know, across the entire landscape, and fairly aggressive residue harvesting rates, looked at 33 and 66%. Like in the top set of maps, you can see we're looking at the feedstock that could be produced meeting a 60% reduction standard, and then in the bottom two maps, if you relax that to 50%. And so there's a pretty sizable difference in terms of how much feedstock can be available. In the top plot, we're sort of plotting, you know, looking between a 60% reduction and a 50% reduction, how that availability will respond. If you relax it all the way down to 50%, essentially all of the residues that are being produced in the region would qualify, whereas at 60%, it's a pretty small percentage. The take-home there could sort of be two take-home messages there that come to mind. First, you could say, well, maybe we should reduce the standard a little bit, and then you'll, you know, sort of increasing the total mitigation because you're just multiplying the reduction by the amount of fuel that is being displaced. The route that we'll be looking at subsequently, we're, you know, asking ourselves, with relatively modest adjustments to the greenhouse gas intensity through conservation measures, you know, you could offset some of these impacts and allow a greater percentage of the feedstock supply to meet this standard. Just as sort of a first cut, we looked at a small subset of sites, and just to show, you know, how the model is sort of simulating responses of some relevant system outputs, like soil erosion or soil carbon or yield, to some of the different conservation management or residue harvest rates. We're looking at different intensities of tillage and inclusion or lack of inclusion of cover crops. In terms of soil erosion, you can see that the effects are, like, fairly balanced between the three. we get sort of a negative, inclusion of cover crops is reducing the soil erosion considerably, as is conservation tillage, and at more aggressive residue rates you see erosion increasing. With soil carbon, it's sort of more dramatic effect, where carbon is sort of where cover cropping is sort of the most impactful measure here, whereas the tillage has a more modest positive effect and residue harvesting having a more modest negative impact. And then in terms of yield, we're sort of seeing like a dominant side impact, but you see sort of a smaller negative impact of cover cropping, a slight positive impact for conservation tillage, and then some reduced yield levels at more aggressive residue harvest rates. But sort of highlighting from a soil carbon perspective that the cover cropping is sort of shown as the dominant effect here. And this is not necessarily representative of the whole regional responses, just looking at a small subset, but sort of just an initial cut to demonstrate that. And then just sort of illustrating maybe some of the underlying factors that may be driving this. All of those management effects would impact the surface residue cover. And there's sort of like a clear response between surface residue cover and erosion, which you would expect. Whereas in terms of soil carbon and yield, you see more interactions with the other treatments in addition to just their impacts on surface cover. So, I guess initially we identified about 5 different sites with a number of different treatments across the U.S. Midwest. And we're looking for experiments that would include, that are monitoring crop productivity and soil carbon over time. That would include some of the management measures, different rates of residue removal, and inclusion or exclusion of cover crops in corn or corn-soybean rotations, as well as looking at dedicated perennials. So here we focused on switchgrass and miscanthus, which are sort of 2 of the more widely studied potential dedicated bioenergy crops. Sort of just an aggregated study. We did some calibration and evaluation procedures and found the model to be performing fairly well in terms of simulating the productivity and soil carbon stocks of these systems. There's sort of too much information in the plot here to capture, but it's just sort of showing the positive impact of the different dedicated bioperennial crops on soil carbon stocks. And we can look at it sort of a little more closely by aggregating. So here we're just looking at the impact of some of these different systems relative to our reference treatment, which we would consider like a corn soy rotation with no cover crop and no residue being harvested. So you can see like the dramatic positive effect of the switchgrass and miscanthus stands, and then also you can see the increased productivity of the continuous corn versus soybean, and then the positive impact relative to this direction of cover cropping versus no cover cropping, and then sort of reductions as you go down the aggressive residue harvesting rates. But so we were interested in sort of understanding, well, how much of the residue harvesting can be offset through incorporation of the cover crops to the system. So sort of fitting just a linear regression over here and sort of estimating roughly for the continuous corn rotations comes out to about 20% residue harvest, and for the corn soy about 40%, which would be a pretty sizable amount of harvest that would be considered soil carbon neutral, and would definitely free up a sizable amount of residue regionally. Sort of shifting and looking at the soil water balance impacts, you can see here we added a new some updated soil water routines to the EPIC and APEX model. We've put in sort of like an empirical approach for doing this, and also like a Richards-based approach, and tested these at multiple sites and at watershed scale. And here we're just sort of looking at some average simulations versus observations for the different methods versus depth, and over here sort of the stream flow analysis. And overall, it's just showing that seemed to have a positive influence. And then we wanted to look at this, so the as part of like a Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. They have a biofuel cropping system experiment in southwest Michigan. And they actually have, you know, it's a great data set. They have a bunch of different biofuel cropping systems that they're looking at. Here we're just looking at continuous corn and switchgrass. And they have sort of TDR probes down to a meter and a quarter. And but yeah, overall the model seems to be tracking these fairly well. And so we sort of did like a regional study. These are just showing like a 9-county region in southwestern Michigan. And so we're sort of doing like 56-meter pixel simulations across this area and looking at the impacts of, you know, continuous corn, conventional till, no-till versus switchgrass plantings. And there's a fair amount of variability across the landscape, but overall, you can see that we're estimating sort of an increased water use through elevated ET for the switchgrass relative to the continuous corn rotations, you know, which is sort of magnified if you're comparing it relative to the no-till systems slightly. Although in terms of, you know, efficiency of conversion of water into, you know, bioenergy, the switchgrass systems seem to be more efficient. And then in terms of water quality, the impacts are more positive for the switchgrass systems, where you can see like a considerable reduction in nitrogen loss. And if you split it into sort of productive lands versus marginal lands, it's a bit more dramatic. So the outlook for planting, you know, switchgrass onto marginal lands, which is something that's been explored extensively, you know, seems to check out based on this analysis. So overall, yeah, study findings, we seem to see that, you know, some of these new tools and model applications seem to demonstrate that, you know, the model is useful for considering, you know, the soil carbon and water impacts of, you know, biofuel producing systems. Some of these longer-term simulations seem to indicate some, you know, the positive impacts and how, you know, incorporation of cover crops could be like a key tactic for offsetting some of these deleterious soil and environmental quality impacts of such measures. And the dedicated perennial crops could be like a nice tactical way of, you know, producing cellulosic fuels with positive environmental impacts on marginal lands. And it could free up, you know, the feedstock, potential feedstock supply from the region. So I don't know, sort of as next steps, we're looking to look into, you know, more explicitly the impact of cover crops on water use and nitrogen leaching, and incorporate these into a larger regional assessment where we're looking at sort of tactical landscapes where you'd be, you know, planting perennial crops onto marginal lands and also as riparian buffers, and then looking at this at larger, you know, watershed relevant scales with water quality issues or across the greater U.S. Midwestern region. And then we're sort of integrating this into like a supply chain techno-economic analysis where we'd be looking at some issues like because you know, the problem, the energy density of residues is so low, so there's like some logic between using like acid pretreatment or aphex pretreatment to densify the energy, which can have other benefits, including use for animal feed. But then, so you could look at, you know, using a depot system versus directly transporting to biorefineries, which also has impact on how large of a biorefinery you could produce. So then you could look into like co-location with energy plants. So there's a lot of sort of logistic and operational trade-offs there. And then also we have look into some of the biodiversity impacts that would be associated with just sort of the change in land use and land cover. So.
Yeah, thank you for that.